Welcome to the Eco News Report, your weekly environmental news show. My name is Tom Wheeler, and I'm the executive director of EPIC, and I'm joined by my friends and colleagues, Larry Glass of the North Coast Environmental Center. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Tom.
Jen Kalt of Humble Baykeeper.
Hello.
And Scott Greason of Friends of the Eel River.
Hey, Tom.
All right. On today's show, we are going to talk about the Terrigen project. We're going to breach this discussion that I've tried to avoid for so long because it was so toxic and so terrible. But now we get to do a little bit of a post-mortem.
It's just that you were wrong.
It's just I was wrong. I'm just such a whatever. I'm wrong to everybody, so that's fine. So we can do a little bit of a post-mortem here, discuss what the heck actually happened there and lessons that we can take away from it, and then start to chart a path forward. Because when the Terrigen project did fail, we did lose an opportunity for relatively low carbon energy in Humboldt County. And this is something that we're going to need in the future as we try to combat climate change. So we need to figure out what the heck is next.
And everybody knows it's up to the enviros to decide what happens next. So.
I would like to be in charge of my own future personally. So yeah. I'll tell folks what we should do. And I did in an op-ed in the North Coast Journal, which you can read online.
And it's pretty good.
It's okay. So let's just start off by saying, what happened? Just very literally, what was the vote before the Board of Supervisors?
Well, what was before the supervisors initially was to certify the EIR.
The Environmental Impact Report, which is the environmental analysis document that accompanied the project.
Right. The CEQA document, if you will.
The CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act document. That
need a glossary for the show.
We're just going
to trying to get away from the acronyms as much as we can, but sometimes we need reminding. But anyways, that was the first thing that was up for a vote. That vote failed then. Much to people in the audience's surprise, the vote failed.
So I believe it was a resolution by Supervisor Bass of Eureka, and it was seconded by Rex, who was the chairman. It failed to get a third vote in favor. The project didn't get approved, but then the Board of Supervisors had to move on and actually disapprove the project. They couldn't just not approve it, which is kind of a weird...
Yeah, but that's what John Ford directed that the supervisors needed to do, was up or down on the project. So then that vote happened, and that was actually 4-1 because Virginia changed her vote on the second vote.
So the supervisors ultimately rejected the project. I know it was close because a number of the supervisors were torn on this project, as many of us in the community were. So on one hand, we had the concerns raised by the Wiat tribe about cultural issues with the project site. Environmentalists also raised some concerns about the individual impacts associated with the project, although I don't think that that got as much steam or enthusiasm or whatever in the public dialogue about this project than did the Native American cultural issues did.
But all of that to me, and you know, this is Scott Greason, I like to think I'm paying some attention to local politics. It came as a shock, really.
Absolutely.
That the project was disapproved. I was trying to read the votes a month beforehand, and it looked like a 4-1 yes.
Totally. I think
even up to the week beforehand, it still looked like a sure thing.
Oh, those of us that were sitting in the meeting room and were counting votes on the day the vote happened, we still thought it was 4-1 in favor. But there were rumblings in the audience that we had heard that Estelle had been rethinking her position and was waffling. And then unbeknownst to us, apparently Mike had been talking to Cheryl Seidner.
Mike Wilson.
Mike Wilson had. And apparently, according to Cheryl anyways, well before that meeting had already said that he wasn't going to be able to vote against the tribe. But that was news to us. All of us sitting in the audience, it looked like it was going to be approved.
And let's just try to be a little transparent here. You were sitting in the audience hoping to kill the project. I was actually in favor of the project.
I didn't like the project for three reasons. One, I had environmental concerns about it. I thought it was a very crappy EIR and had bad data in it. But the final moving thing for me was my field trip to Bear River Ridge with Cheryl and Adam, and just being moved by being on the site, and that really tipped the scales for me.
Yeah, my point there wasn't to relitigate it, but just to note that we had different positions.
Right, we definitely did have different positions. Like everybody in this room, we weren't trying to beat our opinion down anybody else's throat particularly. We were expressing our opinions. And
I thought it was interesting with this project, the way that it it was very much grassroots, the opposition to the project, because there wasn't, insofar as we can think of ourselves as the grass tops or whatever,
right,
there weren't formal organizations outside of the Wiat tribe that were trying to direct people to oppose the project. EPIC got yelled at by a number of people because we said, here's the data, you come to your own decision, this is a hard one, and we're not going to tell you what to think. A lot of people wanted us to tell people what they should do. In particular, a lot of people wanted us to tell people to oppose the project, which was somewhat uncomfortable.
Yeah, we got the same kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, from my perspective, it was like, well, this is not great, but what's the alternative if we're going to get to carbon-free electricity anytime in the near future, much less on the kind of timeline it looks like we have to? We got to start doing that.
Yep.
We said no. Okay, now what? Honestly, I don't think solar rooftops and microgrids are going to do it.
So grassroots versus grass tops support for this project, that was something that stood out for me. And then the degree to which the concerns of the Wiat tribe really were animating for people at the grassroots. Mm-hmm. Mike Wilson said something, Supervisor Mike Wilson, during the hearing that was a very smart encapsulation of the issue, which was it appeared that the county and the company followed the law, but that in following the law, the Wiat tribe still did not feel heard, though. And so it appears that the law is insufficient, perhaps, to meet the needs of local tribes for a project like this. So I think that this is likely going to send some shivers down the spines of any other developer who is thinking about a large project in Humboldt County, trying to figure out, well, then what the heck do I do? I imagine if you're Nordic Aqua Farms or whoever, you're going to be worried. And this is the good thing, probably reaching out to the Wiat tribe a lot earlier and a lot more in depth than you had previously.
Well, right, too, Tom. But, you know, consultation is not just checking a box on a piece of paper.
Yeah, but unfortunately, that is kind of legally what it is. But then,
Right. For Caltrans, everything is checking a box.
Yeah,
a piece of paper, but yeah.
Right. But that's the lesson to take home from this: is that they checked the box, but it didn't suffice.
And so, when we say check a box, there is very literally in the CEQA process now a box that you have to check.
Right. In 2019, there was a new section added to the CEQA checklist on tribal cultural resources. You know, when you say checking the box, I mean, it's been evolving in the last few years. It's not necessarily something that the county has become an expert at as lead agency, but as the members of the public, we don't really know what the tribal consultation process looked like because it's confidential. If you think about it, a lot of times environmental laws may have been followed according to the letter of the law, check the box, even though we know it wasn't done well enough. But tribal rights are really coming into their own now in a big way. We saw that with the Trinidad Rancheria Hotel proposal that there was a lot of opposition to on various levels that probably would have never gotten approved if it was not on tribal trust land. But things are changing. People need to acknowledge that things are changing and do a better job of adapting to the new situation for project proponents. So hopefully the future renewable energy project proponents will look at this and do a better job. Hopefully the county as the lead agency will do a better job as well. And hopefully people will learn to have more communication and build relationships amongst different groups. Like the renewable energy experts are kind of in a silo. The environmental groups are kind of in a silo. And tribal representatives are kind of in their silo, and we need to have more communication, more trust, more willingness to talk about issues in an informal way before people can start to have the formal consultation process without everyone just walking away saying, well, we didn't get what we want, we're going to fight this project to the death.
So one thing I would point out that I noticed was early on in the process, the public was involved. And they were going to these public sessions that Terrigen was holding. A lot of the public, and I'm not trying to speak for everybody, but there was a lot of people there that felt like they were being branded as NIMBYs and their concerns were being discounted. And I think what happened is they begin to see, as they kept going to these meetings, well, nobody gives a damn about what I think, but they sure seem to care about what the Wiat people think. That's where you saw the opposition begin to gravitate towards, the Wiat don't like this, because it felt like people were listening to them.
So I hope that this movement, the folks who did kind of attach themselves to the We Out Tribes concerns, that this is not just a kind of a fleeting temporary alliance, but that we can ultimately have more long-term sustained respect for tribal sovereignty. That was something else that bothered me a lot, was wondering whether people's kind of articulation of their concerns was true or valid, or whether they were hiding it. And maybe I shouldn't try to look too deeply into the motives behind people when they say something, and that's ultimately the best thing to do. But I always felt somewhat squeamish that folks were potentially just kind of grappling on, because it was more politically correct to do that than to say, I don't think I'm going to like to have the flashing lights in my backyard.
And there was certainly some of that, Tom. But I also met some folks that I've had interactions with during the timber battles. I interacted with them, and I actually think they truly took to heart the Wiat concerns as things went along.
And there's always something like this that gets us to begin to care about something in the first place. So maybe that this is the portal, this is the entry point for them to become committed social justice warriors or something. So, Scott, you said something.
Well, I think it's important to emphasize that the county's decision to say no doesn't leave a possibility of that one coming back. It's done. It's gone. It goes away. My understanding is there was a tax issue where they were going to use some money for this and not for that.
Ooh, I don't know, Scott.
You don't know that.
Yeah, okay. I don't think that's true.
The tax... Okay.
There was this whole thing beforehand that's like, we got to do this or not. So is that true or not?
So there was a tax incentive that was supposedly driving the timeline and the kind of the urgency that was going to expire in December.
But they got it delayed on that.
But it was extended. I think it was the day...
It was the day the supervisors voted to deny the project that federal tax credit got extended for another year.
Huh.
So it's possible.
So we can tear ourselves all the pieces about this all over again.
Absolutely. So it seemed that the Wiat Tribe's concerns were primarily focused on Bear River Ridge. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if there was a project that came back that was not on Bear River Ridge, that was more concentrated on Monument Ridge, whether the tribal concerns could be mollified. Or is there some other way to work with the Wiat Tribe to address their concerns for Bear River Ridge? I think the people who know most about that are going to be the Terrigen folks, and I bet that they're licking their wounds and wondering how to recoup a little bit of the $13 million that they lost in planning this project and gain it this far. Right. There's a lot of data that they've collected.
Right. And that's the interesting thing to me, is you don't usually walk away from that. So,
yeah, stay tuned. Maybe something will be back.
Wow.
Although I have no special knowledge of that being the case.
Nor do I, but I just know the door is not closed.
Okay. So glad I brought that up.
Yeah, that's really important. So, Scott, you said something about we need to figure out what's next.
Well, I don't know about you, but like the idea that we're just going to sit here and put better bumper stickers on our cars and let the atmosphere turn steadily hotter and the ocean turn steadily more acidic, you know, it just doesn't work. We aren't the only people on this planet, and we got to do our part.
Just a reminder of what the IPCC report from 2019 said, which is we need to achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050 with a significant cut, approximately 50%-ish, by 2030.
That's basically next week on these kind of timelines.
Absolutely. Yeah. 2030 is when the offshore project could possibly be built.
Right.
We're looking at decades-long time scales at this point.
I watched Greta speaking to the conference in Davos this morning on the internet, and she was talking about gigatons of carbon that we're producing, and her data sound even more dire than what you just quoted.
Yeah, every time it seems like there's a new report, it becomes more dire, because it is becoming more dire. We're getting further down the path, and then the options for us to transition are harder. To put this project into perspective, Humboldt County's greenhouse gas emissions, 13% come from electricity consumption. That is looking at the larger, what percent renewables are in the larger grid mix that we buy from, and the amount of energy we use. To figure out how much this project would have actually reduced that is somewhat difficult. but it would have had a direct effect on greenhouse gas emissions because the Humboldt Bay Generating Station, which is a natural gas-fired power plant, would have produced less energy. That's just the way that it was kind of connected to the grid and the way that the grid prioritizes different points of energy production. Our largest source of greenhouse gas emissions here in Humboldt County is transportation. And of course, electrification of the transportation industry is going to be one of the necessary tools to reduce carbon emissions associated with transportation. We're not doing a whole lot of good unless we start to have that electricity come from renewable, low-carbon sources. So having a good, clean electric mix is inherently important to Humboldt County ever trying to do something towards climate change.
We're talking about TerraGen, lessons learned, and what the heck are we going to do moving forward?
There is a question now of what is next. I put forward an op-ed in the North Coast Journal a couple weeks ago that outlined one potential vision for what's next, which is one of the things that came up over and over again in the TerraGen discussion was that this is some sort of outside company that's going to get rich off of exploiting the climate crisis and us poor, rural, dumb Humboldt County voters. And so it seems that if we want to have renewable energy, we should try to produce it ourselves. And so the way to do that would potentially be...
I thought it was easier to get the capitalists to make it, but okay.
Yeah, I know. So, I mean, that means that we'll need to come up with the money, the capital, to install something like this. And that's $200 to $300 million for an equivalent size project.
Right.
Not an insubstantial chunk of money. So we need to come up with it somehow. And a municipal bond would be one measure.
Sure.
So there are two types of municipal bonds that we could pursue. One is based on our total kind of capacity to add debt to ourselves, our debt to asset ratio. And the other is a revenue type municipal bond. Revenue type bonds you might be familiar with if there's a large bridge project that then has a corresponding toll booth. The toll booth will produce revenue to be able to pay off the bond. So we have two different options on how to do this. And that is one way that we could get to some sort of a future. But in my op-ed, I was very explicit to say that our future is going to need to rely on a diversity of energy sources. And this brings up the question of rooftop solar.
You mean that wonderful bridge fuel natural gas, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it is going to rely a bit on bridge fuels like natural gas, but more so...
My mom says we need to burn that bridge when we get to it.
Yeah. But more so looking to the future, we're going to have a diversified portfolio of energy. And this is like one of the most obnoxious truisms, but the sun isn't always shining and the wind isn't always blowing, right? So we're going to have something or some sort of large-scale storage technology, which doesn't yet exist.
Right, but we're going to have to electrify basically everything.
Yeah, everything.
Yeah.
So, but this brings up this issue of rooftop solar, and that was one of the large points of discussion in the TerraGen project.
This is the glib response to, we have an energy crisis, we've got to figure out how to make it, and the easy response is, well, why don't we just put solar panels on top of everything?
You know, it is a tempting answer, but why don't we put solar panels on top of everything?
When's the last time you went up on a roof, Tom? You know how easy it is to break your leg up there?
Yeah.
It's a lot of extra hassle. And when you do things the slow way, it costs more money. It's going to take longer and it's going to cost a lot more to do that. Likewise, this idea of building a zillion microgrids. Microgrids are great for things like casinos and hospitals that have to have power and have a way to pay for them. But basically, it's a way to cut yourself off from the grid. So it doesn't really answer the question, how do we supply power to the grid? You're saying, well, I'm going to cut myself off. I'm going to have my own special, super expensive grid. That's not an answer. We got to provide power to all of us.
I have a little different opinion than Scott, I think,
because shocker. I don't
see, there's a diversity of opinions in environmentalism.
I don't want to dismiss the solar concept just out of hand like that.
I'm not dismissing it. I'm just saying it's not the answer.
And I agree with you there. It's not the answer. There is no one the answer. But I certainly think as part of a healthy mix, diversity, as Tom was calling it, of energy sources, we should be exploring solar more than we are. I took advantage of Governor Brown when he was governor the first time, had a rebate program, and I put solar panels on my house in Trinity County, and I've been making my own power out there. I've never been on the grid. There's no even opportunity for me to be on any grid out there.
Totally.
And I think that that is a good
thing. My folks live off the grid. Same
thing. I think it's a good thing for people to start experiencing because – I have such a different mindset when I'm in Trinity County. Like, I know how much power everything I have uses, and I calculate ahead of time when I'm going to use that power and how I use it. When I'm in town, I don't even think about it. I just flip the light switch and power comes on. I think it's really a much healthier thing to do, to be calculating all that stuff and using less. I use so much less power out there. I have to budget my power. I think it's a healthy thing for us to get involved. It is not the only solution. There shouldn't be any commercial buildings that don't have solar on top of them.
The reality is, though, is that it's expensive and that the vast majority of the population is not going to start counting their kilowatts. It's like saying, I'm going to stop using plastic bags, and then you go to Sacramento and see the trash cans overflowing with all the plastic and styrofoam, and we're not making a dent unless we make it easy for people. Like, for example, if you want people to walk and bike more, it has to be easy. It has to be safe. You know, it can't just be the ascetics among us who say, I'm committed to riding my bike to work 1 hour each way every day, and I'm going to do it, and I'm going to live my life this way, you know, because it's hard. It takes a lot of time. And if you have kids, you can't really do it.
And poor people are at a disadvantage with all of these solutions. There's no question about it. But to me, I'm not an anti-government person. I believe government is supposed to help in situations like this. Instead of spending money fighting with Iran, I would much more see us providing low-income people with alternative energy. To me, that's a much better use of our tax dollars.
Well, and I hear you and Tom agreeing on something fundamental here, which is that we can get together and figure out how to do this. And that makes sense to me. It just doesn't make sense to say the only way we're going to do it is with rooftop solar and microgrids. That's not how we're going to do it. We need some bigger sources.
We need industrial scale energy production because we use energy at an industrial scale.
Right.
And exactly. we need to plan for not just the environmentalists listening to this program, but everyone in society to be using renewable power, whether or not they want to, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
We live in a society.
Yeah.
And we should talk about the offshore wind proposal. That's not really a proposal yet, but it's in the works. People
the next best thing. Yeah.
The Terrigen discussion pointed to that and said, that's what we should be doing.
I'm not against wind. I'm just against this wind project. I'm for the offshore project.
Right.
What are the hurdles that the offshore project is going to run into?
Well, it's very expensive. It's going to have to be a certain size for it to pencil out, as most of these things do. But also, we don't really know that much about the ocean 20 plus miles offshore. We don't know a lot about the whales and the other marine mammals, the critters, the seabirds. You know, we know a lot more about them close to shore, of course, because that's where
easier
we are.
To watch them. Yeah.
You know, there have to be a lot of studies done to look at all these critters that are out there and what sort of impacts are going to be involved with an offshore wind project. And, you know, hopefully they'll be doing a lot more thorough research in that vein so that we don't have a couple of years of quickie studies and said, you know, let's call it good and just build this and deal with the impacts later. Because, you know, some of those critters they're talking about are orcas, you know, that are migrating through, or humpback whales and gray whales that live here. I don't know how much they're using that area. I don't know if they'll avoid the area of wind turbines or if there's a potential for them to be impacted by all the cables. I mean, there's a lot to be worked out with that still.
One of the most concerning things I've heard is that these could function as kind of attractive nuisances, mm-hmm. ecological traps, where it provides new things to draw in wildlife than to be impacted by the offshore wind platform.
Yeah.
So we risk a future that in 10 years, we'll discover that there are all sorts of harmful, horrible, unavoidable impacts associated with offshore energy production. And we're going to be 10 years further down the line. We're going to be at the point where we were supposed to have made 50% total greenhouse gas reductions already. And yeah, we're kind of playing with fire to say, well, there's going to be this other thing better that's going to come.
Literally playing with fire. And it should be said that we haven't done floating offshore wind turbines off the coast of North America yet. This would be a new thing. And it's, you know, it's pretty exciting. Scotland, Norway. Yeah. It's pretty exciting, too. You know, it has the potential to be a really positive thing. But there are so many unknowns at this point. Hopefully, because Redwood Coast Energy Authority is the project proponent and has a team of wind developers and engineers and scientists, because it's a government agency, hopefully there's going to be much more intensive environmental studies and tribal consultation, consultation with fishermen, all the things that need to happen so that, you know, it's not all of a sudden a big surprise that, oh, well, 30 orcas are going to be killed or something like this. I think the current thought is that maybe 5 to 10 years is what we're looking at to develop an offshore wind project here. You know, and there's a lot of questions still around that, so.
Last thoughts? Anyone else?
It's a big problem, and we're all going to have to participate in the solution.
Whether we like it or not.
That's correct.
I guess I'm wondering how the Condor piece fits in. I'm not sure it does at all. We're talking mostly about energy now. I guess I'm wondering, you know, what other things we're not thinking about now that we're going to have to start thinking about. There's this offshore wind project, but as you pointed out, RCEA has a target of 100% carbon-free power. To do that, they're going to have to buy power from projects elsewhere in California. So in a lot of ways, we're exporting our footprint.
Instead of buying power from the Humboldt Wind Project, we're probably going to buy it from the Hatchet Ridge Wind Project over, I think, in Shasta County. So power is going to have to come from somewhere.
Right. And somebody will be looking at those towers. Yeah.
Importing fracked natural gas from wherever it comes from, Alberta.
Kern
County.
So the other thing is to somewhat keep all of this in perspective, too. Which is, as I said before, the forthcoming Humboldt County Climate Action Plan has electricity consumption at 13% of total greenhouse gas emissions attributable to Humboldt County. And the vast majority is transportation. Energy, thankfully, is the thing that's kind of easiest to solve. It is the low-hanging fruit because we can swap fuels. You know, an electron looks the same whether or not it comes from a nuclear plant or a gas plant or a wind farm. What's going to be hard is undoing a century of land use planning that inherently results in greater greenhouse gas emissions. This is where like everyone will be like, oh, this is just Agenda 21. Environmentalists trying to let, you know, force us to have a certain way of life and blah, blah, blah. But we need to more or less depopulate the rural parts of America, concentrate populations in cities where we can better serve humanity and have greater efficiency and reduce total transportation. That's going to be the hard part.
Also,
the hard part, the really hard part, is there needs to be less humanity.
That too.
More humanity, fewer humans.
Well, that's true.
Jen and I are doing our part by not having kids, that is. And so the first half, so again, thinking back to we need to make a 50% reduction by 2030, that's not the most difficult half. The second half is going to be the extremely hard part.
Right.
There are things now that I will probably need to endorse. I didn't think I would have had to endorse in the past. Carbon sequestration technology and actually developing that stuff and getting it productionable and at scale, it's probably going to have to be part of it now because we've just dug ourselves such a deep, deep hole.
And I think that's the part of this process that was both discouraging and real for me is like we said yes to something we didn't want to say yes to.
Which is fracked natural gas?
No, which was the wind farm project, the Terrigen project.
Oh.
Everybody else said no to it, but I really feel like ultimately we're all going to wind up having to say yes to things we don't want to. Because the alternative is the world saying to us, no.
Well, I would also like to commend Friends of the Eel River for the position that you did take, because it was, frankly, the more difficult one to take in light of where the rest of the kind of progressive community was, right? Whenever I said anything like moderately in favor of the project or just moderately neutral about the project, I would invariably wake up to an inbox full of pissy emails. And these are coming from potential funders. These are coming from friends. These are coming from a lot of folks who I care a lot about.
Yeah.
This was hard to work on because in part it was so contentious. The feelings were just so raw on particularly the anti side. Although I know that there were a number of folks who were just as gung-ho on the pro side. But so kudos to you because Friends of the Eel River had a lot of backbone to issue a statement that said, you know, this isn't the worst thing in the world, guys.
Apparently it was.
I mean, it was flawed enough that it was ultimately rejected by the Board of Supervisors. And I believe that that was an acceptable decision.
There's another outcome that you guys haven't talked about, and that's the outcome that it was going to get litigated and it was going to get modified through litigation. So we don't know what the ultimate outcome was going to be.
Yeah, it's possible. From my understanding, the whole point of litigation would have been just to kill the project.
Certainly that was, you know, but you know with a CEQA suit that that's only a temporary outcome of CEQA suit. Eventually what happens is you modify the project. So that would have been the ultimate outcome.
We would have also had tree sitters blocking construction of a wind project. It would have been in the New York Times.
Oh, there was talk about making it the new cause celeb with people coming from the Midwest to Humboldt County to protest.
So
I heard that.
We avoided that fate, so thank God. So the county, together with all of the major jurisdictions in the county, have collaborated to create this multi-jurisdictional climate action plan. So it consists of three main parts, the first of which is an accounting of our total greenhouse gas emissions. And throughout the show, I've discussed this a bit.
Right.
The next is the target. This is what we as Humboldt County want to do. So this is a total emissions reduction target, and it can be framed in multiple different ways, and they haven't come up with the way that they want to frame it yet. And then the third bit is how we could achieve that target. So these are the specific strategies. You know, what if we gave all county employees bus passes? How much greenhouse gas emission reductions could we associate with getting people to take the bus a little bit more rather than driving in their car? And so there'll be a whole kind of laundry list of things that we can do and associated potential greenhouse gas emissions for those different things. So
but this is all on the emission side.
It's all on the emissions.
About the impacts of climate change.
None of it's about the impacts of climate change. And there, to my knowledge, isn't a ton on sequestration. So we are blessed with, I think, you know, the most productive timber county in California. So we have a lot of potential to...
Probably the galaxy?
Yeah, you know, Tongass National Forest maybe. But yeah, we have a lot of potential to sequester greenhouse gases through changes to land management. And we have a lot of potential to sequester carbon through recreating historic salt marshes, which are a fantastic carbon sink. So there are other things that we can do as well. And hopefully some of that will be in there. But a lot of stuff when it comes to land management decisions are just outside of our hands. Timber operations are wholly regulated by the state, and Humboldt County can't tell timber companies what to do, even if we want it to. So we have our hands partially tied, and I hope that we will also, as a county, as a state, begin to think about ways that we can promote proforestation and sequestration of carbon in healthy, diverse forests. Thanks, all.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Eco News Report. Join us on this time and channel next week for more Eco News.